Today's case takes us to the quiet suburb of Montclair in New Jersey. Three women died in apartment 31 at different times. It would be a while before police made the connection that resulted in the arrest and conviction of one man who had a fascination with returning to the same apartment, which the locals started to believe was cursed. Hi, I'm Lee, and this is True Crime Queen. I post solved and unsolved, lesser-known cases each week. If this is for you, please consider subscribing and click the bell to be notified of new uploads. Today's case takes place in the USA, in the suburb of Montclair. Montclair is a small town of less than 40,000 people, close enough to commute to New York and where you can see the New York skyline without having the big city bills. The town is known for its arts community, well-established sports centres and beautiful parks, with a large amount of postcard-perfect historic buildings. Montclair is also one of the safest cities in America with a low crime rate and rarely a murder, but in the space of 3.5 years, there would be 6 deaths in Montclair. Now, this may not be unusual for some towns, but for Montclair, this spike in murder was really odd, particularly as all 6 deaths took place on the same quiet road. Even stranger, 3 of the deaths took place at different times in the same apartment. Apartment 31, Cranetown Apartments, at 77 Orange Road. Today we're going to talk about the 3 deaths in apartment 31. There are about 100 units in the complex, where a large number of elderly single women live. Many of the residents choose to live within the confines of the complex, barely leaving the grounds other than to get groceries and other necessities. On the 30th of November 1981, Lillian Harris was found dead in apartment 31. The apartment is just 1 bedroom and Lillian lived there on her own. At 88, she was elderly like many of the residents in Cranetown Apartments. And although neighbours were surprised at her death, it wasn't unexpected and her death did not raise any suspicions. An autopsy was carried out and her cause of death was shown as a heart attack. There were a few odd things though. One thing was that her home appeared to have been burgled and some jewellery was missing. It doesn't appear that any investigation was done at that time in relation to the missing items. Life went on and a new resident moved into the apartment. Joan Sherry Late then moved into the apartment. She was born on the 28th of April 1931 in Philadelphia. And at 51, she was considered quite young compared to many of the residents in the complex. She had been married and had 2 children and had a career as a speech therapist. She was now on her own. Apartment 31, being a single bedroom, suited her lifestyle. On the 18th of April 1983, she was found dead in her apartment. And when the police investigated, they found a bedroom window had been opened. The drawers looked like they had been gone through and her purse was missing. An autopsy was performed and the cause of death was withheld, and the police continued to investigate the case. And in the meantime, a new resident moved into the apartment. Sarah McHale was 68 years old when she moved into apartment 31. It had been vacant for 5 months before she moved in, and she'd been living there for just 2 weeks when she was found dead on the 2nd of September 1983. When police investigated, they discovered that Sarah had apparently been strangled and suffocated with a pillow. Just like the previous victims, there were signs of a burglary. A bedroom window had been opened. Sarah's purse was missing, and some jewellery, including a gold chain set with a small diamond. Residents of Cranetown Apartments were alarmed. Although Lillian's death had been dismissed as natural causes, there were now two further deaths that were not. And it also appeared that there was a burglar targeting residents in apartment 31, and maybe even the complex. The locals started to refer to apartment 31 as the curse of Cranetown. Three deaths and robberies in the same apartment in a short period of time certainly made it seem as if the dwelling was cursed. And even though the crimes had only been committed in apartment 31, many residents were still fearful for their own safety, no matter where their apartment was located within the complex. Many increased security at their apartments. Locks were installed on doors and windows, and people just worried for their safety and for their fellow residents. The police did their best to assuage the fears in the neighbourhood by increasing police patrols around the area where the apartment complex was located. And it was at this time that the police also formed the opinion that the three deaths in apartment 31 were all linked and not random attacks. There were a lot of similarities that led to that conclusion. The three victims all lived in apartment 31. They were all single white women. All appeared to have died and been burgled. A bedroom window had been forced open in two of the three cases. All women had lost money and jewellery. And the police theory was that all three victims had been subject to a burglary that resulted in their death. The police devised an elaborate plan to prove that the apartment was not the subject of a curse, but a criminal that was preying on women in the area, and he needed to be caught. The cunning plan was to install one of their own officers as bait in apartment 31 and hopefully catch the killer in the act. And in 1984, they moved furniture into apartment 31 and set about making it look like someone was living there. They put curtains up, had lights connected to an automatic timer, and they even decorated the apartment for Christmas. Mail was sent to the address, and more importantly, each day their bait, a female police department secretary, would visit the apartment a number of times. Undercover police officers would be stationed around the apartment to observe her comings and goings, and more importantly, keep an eye out for any potential suspects. And to the public, it looked like the apartment was occupied by a single woman. And it seemed like a reasonable plan, but despite the resources committed to the plan, nothing happened. No suspects were identified, no suspicious activity was noted, and thankfully, there were no further deaths in apartment 31. As the operation was not delivering any results that could assist the investigation, it was abandoned in early 1985. And even though the police abandoned their undercover operation at apartment 31, they'd never given up trying to close the case. Deputy Chief John Corcoran said they had looked at 150 people, compiled more than 8,000 pages of reports. He said the crimes are unprecedented here. There's absolutely no contest between any homicide or any other case we've had in the past. He said that they devoted thousands of man hours to the investigation over the last 2 years. They'd spent years with a number of officers working on the case. Their investigation was in depth and they weren't afraid to ask for help. They obtained assistance from federal, state, county, local and out-of-state law enforcement officers over this period. They even sought the views of colleagues in other countries like Canada to explore techniques for investigating the case. They had questioned people all the way to California for their investigation. And although the police hadn't found anything suspicious near the Grangetown apartments during this time, there was a man that aroused their suspicions. On the 16th of December 1984, the main person on the radar was Jerry Spraggins. He was found at another apartment complex in the area and arrested and charged on the same day with criminal trespass, which is basically an unlawful entry onto a property with the intention of committing a criminal offence. This was not a deterrent for Spraggins because 3 days later, further charges were added, including criminal sexual contact and lewdness. Criminal sexual contact is the most serious of the charges, and lewdness, in short, is exposing your genitals to another. He pleaded guilty on the 24th of January 1985 and was convicted with 2 years probation, a suspended sentence and a fine of $500 plus an extra $25 in court costs. He was the main person of interest in the Apartment 31 murders due to forensic evidence found at the crime scene. He'd been on the radar of the police for over 6 months, but it seems that they just did not have enough evidence to make an arrest and charge him for these crimes. Nothing happened for months after this, and then suddenly, on the 9th of April 1985, 30-year-old Jerry Spraggins was arrested and charged with the suspicion of killing Sarah McCall. He gave a statement to the police at the time and it incriminated him. He told police he had been peeping through the windows at 77 Orange Road. The police wanted more details, so they escorted him to the crime scene and had him identify the window he was peeping through. And it was while he was with police at the property that he took the opportunity to run away. He didn't get very far and was caught soon afterwards. He then admitted to breaking into Sarah McCall's apartment. He told police how he put a pillow over her head to keep her quiet. During the questioning, he later admitted to entering Joan Late's apartment, and he told police he put her in a headlock and proceeded to have sex with her. Police obtained a search warrant for his house, which was owned by his parents and their family home. And although the police searched the property, they were unable to recover any further evidence. But there was further evidence directly linking Jerry Spraggins to the burglary of Sarah McCall, and it came from his own family. Jerry Spraggins' father attended the police station and gave them jewellery that had been found by his daughter Shonda at his home. The jewellery was identified as belonging to Sarah McCall. And on the 13th of April, he was charged with the murder, aggravated sexual assault, burglary and criminal theft in relation to Sarah McCall and Joan Late, and theft and burglary of Lillian Harris. When news of the arrest was made public, locals were calling the police to thank them for their hard work. Finally, after more than 2 years, the residents at 77 Orange Road could sleep easily. Jerry Spraggins was born on the 17th of December 1954. He was the third child of seven born to James and Dolores Spraggins, and little is known about his early childhood, other than he attended Montclair High School and graduated with a diploma on the 14th of June 1973. He lived the bulk of his life at his parents' home at 389 Orange Road, Montclair, and after he finished school, it seemed his hobby of tinkering with cars led to a job as a mechanic. He worked on cars as a living, did side jobs for friends, and his parents' backyard was littered with car projects that he was working on. In his early 20s, he first became known to the police for some petty criminal activities. When he was 22 and living with his parents, he was arrested near 101 Gates Avenue which is about 4 minutes' drive from his parents' home. A report had been made to police about a peeping Tom in the area, and Detective James Dock and Gerardo Paris responded to the call. They found Jerry Spraggins in the apartment complex. A search of his car was conducted and a small amount of devil's lettuce was found. He was charged with possession of a controlled and dangerous substance, the devil's lettuce being under 25 grams, and the peeping Tom offences. He was allowed out on bail after payment of a bond of $250. He appeared in the local court on the 2nd of May 1976 and pleaded guilty to 4 counts of being a peeping Tom and was put on probation. He had some minor problems with the law 4 years later. When he was 25 in 1980, he was fined $200 for driving without a license. And an extra $25 for contempt of court. And in the same year, he was also fined $250 for theft of gasoline. His previous criminal history certainly outlined that he was a peeping Tom, and also that he had no problems with stealing items. His co-workers and friends described him as a loner, but a top-notch mechanic. And at the time of his arrest, he was also employed as a cab driver for the Claridge Taxi Company on Park Street. His workmates were shocked at his arrest, all saying that he was an excellent mechanic. He never bothered anyone and he often worked 7 days a week. At the cab company, one female worker said there were times he was difficult to work with. He would often take the cab and drive without anyone knowing where he was. And he also had a tendency to leave the cab without checking with the dispatcher. This would cause friction with the owner of the cab company and they'd often argue because of it. And sometimes the owner, Robert Bardi, would fire Jerry Spraggins and he would go off and work somewhere else until the owner had cooled down. He'd then be rehired. As well as the cab work and mechanic work, he continued to work on cars after hours for extra money. And in between working, he had time to have a relationship with Renee Crockett, and the two had a 6-month-old son, Jerry Jr., at the time of his arrest. Renee had an apartment in Claremont Avenue, and he would spend time between her place and his parents' home, just 5 minutes away. As well as the 3 deaths in apartment 31, there was another case at 288 Orange Road that geographically linked Jerry Spraggins to the murder. Angelo Alfano was a 75-year-old retired insurance clerk who was found at 288 Orange Road early Monday morning on the 1st of April 1985. Just 10 days before Jerry Spraggins' arrest. Mr. Alfano had a neighbour who kept an eye on him, and on Monday morning, the neighbour noticed a light on and a door unlocked, which was unusual. The neighbour had last spoken with him on Saturday, the 30th of March, about 9 p.m. He was found slumped over his desk in the living room of his home. The telephone wires were cut to the property and police formed the view that he had interrupted a burglary. He'd been stabbed to death with multiple wounds in his chest and neck area, possibly in the early hours of Monday morning or late Sunday night. The death was similar to the apartment 31 murders in that burglary appeared to be the motive. But the cause of death and victimology was vastly different. Ultimately, Jerry Spraggins was not charged with the murder of Angelo Alfano. On the 3rd of July, a grand jury was convened, and in New Jersey, the grand jury hears the evidence and makes a decision whether formal charges should be laid and if the case goes to trial. The prosecution argued that the forensic evidence linked only Jerry Spraggins to the case. His previous criminal record involved Peeping Tom and theft offences. He was familiar with the area, having lived on the road most of his life, and he passed the apartment complex on the way to and from work. The main evidence that the police relied on was his fingerprint was a match to one on the bedroom screen of apartment 31. And after Sarah McHale's death, the window screen had been found about 10 feet away on the grass, and police were able to obtain a fingerprint from it. Alfred Brown, for the defence, argued that fingerprints and other evidence, including blood samples, saliva, semen and hairs, were taken from his client in an unconstitutional manner before probable cause was established. This argument was unsuccessful, and the judge had to school the defence in the law of precedent. The defence claimed that the death certificates for Lillian Harris and Joan Late stated that they died of natural causes from heart disease, and therefore there was no murder. The prosecution argued that Lillian's body had been cremated without autopsy, with a viewing only, and while Joan Late had an initial autopsy which noted heart disease, further investigation uncovered bruises on her arm and indications that she died of suffocation. Only Sarah McHale had a complete autopsy, and it was found that she'd been smothered, strangled, and been the victim of a sexual assault. In all three cases, the prosecution told the court the screen had been taken out of their window. Jewelry was missing, and the women were found with their nightgowns pulled up on their bodies. Jerry Spraggins was accused for the first time of the murder and sexual assault of Lillian Harris, whose death had previously been noted as natural causes. And even though Lillian's cause of death was a heart attack, the prosecutor hoped to prove that the burglary or attack led to Lillian's response of having a heart attack in the frightening situation. Originally, police had thought that robbery was the motive and sexual assault was the secondary crime, but the statements made by Jerry Spraggins to the police reversed their opinion. This was all about sexual assault, and robbery was just the byproduct of it. Jerry Spraggins was indicted by a grand jury on charges of sexually assaulting, theft, and murdering the three women. And on the 31st of July, he was denied bail. A month later, on the 7th of August 1985, he agreed to be interviewed by the Herald News in the company of his lawyer, and he was hoping that this interview would sway the public, who he felt perceived him as being less than human. His interview concentrated on how he had cooperated with the police, and he told the interviewer in a softly spoken voice that on the 7th of April he was told by his dispatcher that the police had gone to his workplace at Claridge Taxi Company and advised that they wanted him to take some tests. He voluntarily attended the police station to comply with the request and realised then that he was being treated as a murder suspect. He said in the interview that he spent his time looking over law books, trying to understand what he described as an incomprehensible legal system, and the rest of the time spent playing cards or watching TV with other inmates. He optimistically told the reporter that when his innocence is confirmed, he wants to leave the area and start again somewhere else. He said that his mother is very supportive, and her friends are amazed at how she's coping with his arrest. He didn't mention his father. His son was only 9 months old at the time of the interview, but when he said he's old enough to understand, he would advise him to get a good education, avoid trouble, and have a positive outlook on life. Before proceeding with the trial, prosecutor George Snyder had to decide if the state should seek the death penalty, which they ultimately decided to do. And the trial commenced in January of 1986, and despite the admissions made to police, Jerry Spraggins pled not guilty. and the defence had a number of points to raise regarding the statements Jerry had made to the police about the role he had played in the women's death, and asked that the statements not be admitted as evidence in court. The defence claimed that Jerry had not been read his rights correctly and had not signed the statements voluntarily, but under duress. They claimed that he had only signed the statements admitting his part in the women's deaths because he was abused and threatened by police. He alleged the threats included shooting him in the back if he did not sign the statement. He also alleged that he was poked in the head with a pencil, handcuffed to a chair for half an hour, and not read his rights. He claimed the police said, "We are going to get a statement out of you if it takes all day or 3 days." One told him that they had tough guys before, and he was sure that he could break me. During the interview, he said both hands were handcuffed to a chair and he was punched in the stomach and he had been kicked. The judge found in favour of the prosecution and the statements were admitted into court. As well as the evidence already submitted in the grand jury that we talked about before, a number of witnesses also gave evidence for the prosecution. And on the 14th of January, Eleanor Dropka, who lived above apartment 31, identified Spraggins as a man who'd once given her grandmother and a friend a ride home in his taxi. Eleanor said that she heard screams and noises on the night of April 15th, 1983, 3 days before police found Joan Late's body in her bedroom. And she said that she heard a very loud scream, a short scream, and then it stopped. She didn't call the police because she thought someone was having a bad dream. When she saw photos of Spraggins on TV after his arrest, she recalled that this was the man who had given her grandmother and her friend a ride home hours before she heard the screams. And she also said she knew him by sight. She'd seen him many times in a local coffee shop where she worked. Also testifying against Spraggins was his father, James Spraggins Sr., and his sister, Shunda. Shunda told the court that she'd found jewellery in a second floor bedroom of the family home, and she'd given that jewellery to her father, and he ultimately handed it in to the police. It was identified as belonging to Sarah McHale. The medical examiner and the assistant medical examiner both testified that Lillian Harris had literally been scared to death based on her visual appearance. Her facial expression was one of fear. As a result, she had suffered a heart attack. And it's believed that this happened during the process of being burgled and or assaulted. Jerry Spraggins' statements had been admitted into evidence, and then on the 15th of January, these were heard. And in the first statement to police, he told them, "I have this problem about looking in windows." In his statement, he described how he had seen the window when he was walking past 77 Orange Road of an evening. The blinds were up so he could see inside. He explained how twice on these occasions he removed the screen and entered the property. On one occasion, he said he assaulted one woman on the couch and the other in her bed. He said it was dark out. I was walking by 77 Orange Road. The shade was up. I took the screen off. I went into the apartment. I seen a woman on the couch. I put a pillow over her head to keep her quiet and so she wouldn't see me. I laid on top of her and sexually assaulted her. The woman was Sarah McHale. He left the pillow on her head. He stole her pocketbook and gold chain and he left through the window. Jerry Spraggins claimed that when he left the apartment, he thought she was passed out or something, not dead. He told the court how a feeling would come over him at the sight of a woman through an open window. He said, "When I first saw her, she didn't have anything on. I became overpowered by things I don't understand. I regret doing it very much so. I wasn't in my right frame of mind." He described her in his statement as a small lady, middle-aged and white. The photos tended to core in evidence showed her with streams of blood on her face. Hardly the damage that a pillow would cause. In the second statement he gave police 12 hours after, in relation to the death of Joan Late, he again said how he was walking along Orange Road of an evening, and on this occasion he was walking home from work. As was his habit, he looked through the windows on his walk and saw a lady in the window nude. And in his statement to the police, he said that he had climbed through the window. He told police that because of the way he'd found her, nude, he thought that she would readily submit to him. She did not. He described her as a big woman who put up a fight. She got hold of my private parts and I got her in a headlock until she let go. He then sexually assaulted her. He told police that his only intention had been to have sex with her, not to hurt her. He said that when he left, she was still moving and trying to get up. And he ended his statement with, "I know this was a bad thing to do, and I want to take my life about it." Joan Late's death was initially attributed to a heart attack, but later noted as mechanical asphyxia, a fatal loss of consciousness from oxygen deprivation, and no autopsy incomplete was performed. A third statement by Jerry Spraggins was later read by another detective, and in this statement he acknowledged that the jewellery handed into the police by his father was the same jewellery he had stolen from apartment 31. At court, Jerry Spraggins denied the jewellery recovered and handed to police was stolen from the victims. He claimed that it was costume jewellery that he'd found in his taxi over the years. And from a defence point of view, this was an important argument to make, as if found to be true, it would not be a burglary charge, and the felony murder laws and sentencing would not apply. In the statement, Spraggins admitted to breaking in and sexually assaulting the women, but other than the theft of Sarah McHale's jewellery, denied the robberies and murder, believing the women were alive when he left. The prosecution were keen to convict Spraggins on a felony murder charge, and this occurs when a person dies during the commission of a felony like burglary or sexual assault. The prosecution also were asking for capital punishment for the death of Sarah McHale. Capital punishment was in effect in New Jersey from 1982 to 2007. According to the Department of Justice report on death eligible cases, the death penalty could only be sought in relation to Sarah McHale's case. If convicted for Sarah McHale's murder, this could result in his execution. For the cases of Lillian and Joan, if the prosecution proved felony murder, then during the sentencing phase, there would be a minimum 30-year non-parole period. But in order to be successful, the prosecution has to prove first a burglary and or a sexual assault beyond a reasonable doubt. On the 24th of January, the jury of 5 men and 7 women started their deliberations, and the first question they needed to assess was whether Spraggins was guilty of each of the burglary charges. And they took nearly 20 hours over a 4-day period to find him guilty of felony murder, purposeful or knowing murder, aggravated sexual assault and burglary of Sarah McHale. And he was acquitted of the theft charge. He was also acquitted of the charges relating to Joan Late and Lillian Harris. Clearly, the jury felt that the prosecution hadn't proved their case. On the 27th of January, the sentencing hearing began, and the prosecution again pushed for the death penalty. And the defence argued that there were a number of mitigating circumstances that should be taken into account and the death penalty shouldn't apply. The first was that whilst he'd been convicted previously of criminal charges, he'd never actually been jailed. He was of good character, and his mother, Dolores Spraggins, gave evidence of this, saying, "My son, he's a good kid." She described him as kind, gentle, soft-spoken, respectful. And she also told the court he was raised in church and went to Bible school. His lawyer asked her, "Despite everything you have seen and heard in this courtroom, do you believe your son deserves another chance at life?" And she said, "Yes." The main argument was that Spraggan suffered from a mental disease or defect where he couldn't appreciate the wrongfulness of his acts. And the nature of this defect was a compulsive and voyeuristic behaviour towards women, and his psychiatrist gave evidence to this effect. The prosecution called an ex-girlfriend, Marilyn Mack, who testified that Spraggans beat her 15 to 20 times while she lived with him, and she told the court that he insisted that she have sexual relations with him, and he got violent or started yelling or hitting her. She was thrown on the bed, he began to choke her, and he had his hands on her neck. And she said that she could only escape by kicking him. The jury, weighing up the evidence, declined to give the death penalty, and instead he was sentenced to life in prison. He must spend a minimum of 30 years in prison before being eligible for parole. And he was also ordered to pay $5,050 to the state's Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Spraggans actually seemed pleased with the sentence. And after Jerry Spraggans was in police custody and went to jail, it seems the curse of Cranetown was lifted and there were no further suspicious deaths in Apartment 31. And although the police had suspected Jerry Spraggans with the murder of Angelo Alfano, it turns out that this was a crime that could not be laid at Jerry Spraggans' door. Police arrested Robert Lewis Klein, who also lived at 305 Orange Road, for the murder. He was 20 when he was arrested in November of 1985. He was already in a correctional facility at that time for another offence. The police made a break in the case after a tip-off from the public, and he was charged with the murder, burglary, criminal theft, receiving stolen property, unlawful possession of a weapon, and possession of a weapon for unlawful purposes. And the other two deaths on Orange Road during that time, out of the six deaths, were attributed to a murder-suicide. My heart goes out to all those who loved and cared for Lily and Joan and Sarah. They are gone, but they have not been forgotten. Today's case took up a short part of your life to listen to, but for the family and loved ones, their grief and loss will be with them throughout their life. Do you think that Jerry Spraggans should have got the death penalty? If you're listening to the podcast, please leave a review on your favourite platform. It really helps me out. Until next time, stay safe out there.